You're listening to The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
This is your host of The Daily Traditionalist, Matthew Heimbach, and here we are on June 20th, 2016, in the current year. And I'm happy to be able to kick off a new week with my co-host, Dr. Matt Johnson, because we are here to discuss a series of topics that is not getting reported as much in the American media, of course, as it should be. Specifically, the economic meltdowns that are happening both in Europe and in Latin America, that's getting very, very little press, very, very little coverage, because, of course, this attacks the establishment's narrative of economic recovery, of everything is going great, continue supporting globalism and all of our policies, and things will be phenomenal. So first of all, Dr. Johnson, how are you doing today?
Hey, thanks for having me on. I'm a co-host now. Have I gotten a promotion?
You did. Your ribbon and your medal will be in the mail.
Well, it's about damn time.
So let's kick off today with your newfound promotion on the subject. We'll start with France, and then we'll take a trip south of the border into Latin America. But do you want to lay out a little bit, Father, about the Dr. Johnson? I apologize. When we're doing shows, we're professional, not religious. Dr. Johnson, can you go into what's going on in France and what's the history of this? Because things seem pretty rough over there.
Well, the odd thing is, and Western Europe isn't something that I do quite a bit of anymore, just because it bores me. But and I don't really care. The title doesn't matter. I have numerous titles. The only time I get irritated is when it's Mister. Then I get very upset. I get very pompous all of a sudden. The thing is, you know, Germany's doing very well, relatively speaking. France is doing extremely poorly. Now, in the French case, I think the question has a lot to do with the lack of proximity to Russia. What people forget is that the German government over the last decade has plugged itself into the Russian economy pretty clearly and pretty blatantly, going against the rest of the EU on this. They're involving themselves in making separate deals with the Russian state that the French aren't doing. They're plugged into the Eurasian economy, whether they want to be or not. That's a huge part of why they're successful. France, you know, is in a state of social meltdown that because of their immigration policies, they're in a position now where every year, the city, Paris, say they're burned down once a year. You know, it's like the Gaza Strip anymore. And I think this is one of the big things that's destroying the economy there. I guess the official unemployment rate in France is 11%, which means in reality, it's more like 30%.
Well, and the social programs are falling to pieces is what I've heard. I mean, it's funny, you know, the same thing that I saw when I was in Greece with Golden Dawn, when I was going into the Greek parliament, there were actually clashes between the largest farmers organization in Greece and the police because, of course, you know, Syriza, the far left party of all the leftist radicals, said that if you vote for us, there will be no more austerity. There will be only government programs. We're going to help our farmers. We're going to help the working class. Everything's going to be great. And the first thing they did was when they got into power was increase taxes. One of the things that Golden Dawn was the only party to stand against was a vote on under Greek law. Your primary dwelling place could not be foreclosed. You had a kind of a homestead exemption on that. And they were saying, well, there's too much money tied up in this. We need to pay our debts. So the far left party that supposedly cares about the little guy, of course, passed a bill that they can now foreclose on people's primary dwelling places, which was a huge blow, and of course only the nationalists stood against it, and austerity is kicked up and things like that. And Hollande in France seems dead set on just absolutely obliterating everything, and the fact that they've pushed through now in France this new bill that severely weakens the unions. Can you go into a little bit, because, you know, as we've talked about the Soviet Union and things in Russia, how do all these leftists in Western Europe, they don't even seem to pay lip service anymore to the idea of class warfare against the rich. They seem to be doing everything they can to destabilize the working class and to hurt them with all the policies they're passing. So can you give us a little bit of an insight as to what exactly is going on in Western Europe and specifically France with all these austerity policies and the far left, the socialists, destroying labor unions in France and putting the capitalists first. What's going on with all that?
Yeah, it's about time that the French Socialist Party changed its name. It's really ridiculous. You know, they are part of the ruling class. Same thing for the groups in Greece and in the Balkans. It's simply phony politics. They promote themselves as non-radical leftists to the population at large. When these guys gain power, especially if they're new to power, they're overwhelmed by the problems. They don't know what to do. The slogans on the street have no relationship to actual reality. The pressures on them are tremendous. They're overwhelmed, not just intellectually, but personally. One of these parties gets put in a parliament somewhere and is under tremendous pressure from senior members with various committees he's on to start doing things, and he's in serious trouble if he doesn't. Slogans on the street don't help him with that. They don't know what to do. I mean, going on camera and saying we need to leave the EU and create a protectionist society, they know what will happen to them in the press, and chances are their party will abandon them in the midst of this. Now, in France, the Socialist Party, they had one symbolic thing. About 3 years ago, they proposed a 75% millionaire's tax. Now, I started laughing at this, just like I laugh at the high tax rate in Sweden. Every time someone tells me the highest tax rate in Sweden is what, like 90%, I say, do you really think that the CEO of IKEA or the CEO of Volvo is giving almost 100% of his income to the state? They're probably not paying any taxes at all. So these are all symbolic things that have no meaning. Crushing the unions, the plan that they're riding against, for the first time, you know, white people are actually riding for the first time in a few years. It's a matter of making it easier for companies to fire people. Right now, it's hard to do that. The union structure, they're making it very easy to do this, making it very easy to lower wages, and most of all, to do damage to the 35-hour work week, which, you know, something similar exists in other places that doesn't have this kind of problem. This is a giveaway to the wealthy, nothing more.
Well, it just seems to me that every time that these leftists, they are really just towing the party line of the capitalists. I mean, this kind of goes into what we've talked about before, in the idea that the only difference between capitalism and communism is they're just different sides of the same coin. You know, they're intricately linked with one another. And the idea of busting the unions, the idea of increasing the work week, lowering wages, allowing it to be easier for people to be fired and then replaced with the new third world hordes that have arrived in places like France, all this seems to be is just a giant slap in the face to the working class people that voted for them. I mean, do you see any future, especially as we look, you know, into American politics, where I've been able to meet with so many different people that were lifelong Democrats, that were Democrats because their dad was a Democrat, their grandpa was a Democrat, their great-grandpa was a Democrat, and their entire perspective is just so radically shifted when they realize that they don't have a seat at the table. You know, Jeb never would have gotten elected to dog catcher in the modern Democratic Party if it had been this sort of party when he had gotten involved in politics, because they've done everything they can to alienate the white working class, the blue dog Democrat vote. Is this just something that we've seen in America as the Democrats have moved to be the party of homosexuals, of mass immigration, of the give-me-thats for the different diversity coalitions, and the white working class has been just totally abandoned in literally every one of their policies? Is this just that same thing of the supposed left just becoming international capitalists? Is this what's happening in France that you see?
Well, you hit on it already. The question is making it easier for companies to hire and fire. This is happening at the same time as there is this massive third world invasion, meaning that they could fire somebody and then rehire someone for the same job at a fraction of the wage from the third world. Now, the other thing you said that was perfect is that these leftist parties, everyone's listening to this has noticed that all they talk about is race, gender sometimes. They never talk about economics anymore. They have made their peace with the private sector. No one is advocating a totally planned economy anymore. Not even the last place you could find it would be in Russia. No one is advocating for this anymore. They've made their peace with corporate capital. They might not like the massive inequalities, but there's nothing they can do about that. So long as they're dedicated to private capital, which they all are, they have to dedicate themselves to oligarchy in the present system. So what they've fallen back on, and same thing is all over the white world, what they've fallen back on is third world immigration, homosexuality, feminism, having nothing to do with economics. And the simple fact is, it's easier to deal with the private sector than it is with the state. Dealing with the state, for the most part, you need due process. Not always, but it's far in the private sector. You know, these are dictatorships. It's much, you know, and you have an oligarchy, a handful of people controlling the private sector and most of the advanced world. It's much easier to manipulate those people and get them to do things than an entire state apparatus that requires due process. So this has a lot to do with, take American Express in America, for example. American Express is failing. They've been struggling for a long time. But they've been forced to hire a diversity manager who sits on the board of, management board, who gets a huge salary, who is controlling, you know, what third worlders get sent where. And this is their big plan. The private sector has long since signed on to the far left because they have a financial interest in hiring third worlders, both domestically and then going abroad, as well as the left has, you know, completely shifted over to this third world romanticization. So this has become a tremendous sweet deal between the left and corporate capital. They're now long since wedded and extremely tight. Corporate capital is on the far left of the political spectrum on this stuff, and they have a financial interest in it. So you hit it solidly on the head. That's exactly what's going on.
Well, and, you know, it's kind of the amazing thing. One of my former coworkers was a big Bernie Sanders supporter, for instance, and he couldn't stop talking about homosexuals. He couldn't stop talking about the myth of the wage gap between men and women. And, of course, with that, we all know the differences. Of course, the different careers, but then also women take more time off. I mean, all the different things that, you know, even conservative pundits have done studies in different organizations to disprove the myth of the wage gap. But as you said about slogans in the street, they just kind of go with this. I actually outlefted him just because sometimes I like to have fun with that. It was like, you know, comrade, what, you know, you're not even talking about the socialist revolution. We need to destroy capitalism. And I walked him through Noam Chomsky's perspective that capitalism inevitably becomes anti-racist because you need to be able to have a one world system to be able to have the better movement of peoples and goods and things like that, to have lower costs, lower wages. And nationalism, even if you're a leftist, is the only way, as we see in like Latin America, is the only way to actually make socialism happen, whether it's left-wing socialism or national socialism. And he was just so blown away, and he was just like, well, I've never thought about that, but we really need to deal with these, you know, these inequalities and your transgender rights. And I said, where does it say in the Communist Manifesto anything about homosexuals or transgender? Karl Marx himself said that homosexuality was a symptom of the bourgeoisie lifestyle of, you know, these rich elites just laying about, having no connection to toil, no connection to work, and they're just, you know, smoking opium and drinking and having homosexual orgies and things like that, that the original Marxists were even against homosexuality and these radical things. Like, how do you call yourself a socialist when historically, you know, even socialists in the United States 50, 75 years ago were against immigration because it undercut labor unions, it undercut wages, it undercut the working class? How can you support globalism and all of these issues that have nothing to do with economics? What about you as actually socialist? And he just kind of sat and looked at me and was like, well, you know, equality. And then he just kind of like petered off and like wandered off to his job station. And that to me was just so telling. Like, sometimes I really love to just out-left the left to realize, to help them, you know, understand they're not even like actual leftists in the historical narrative. Their entire perspective is just based upon these things that have nothing to do with economics, has everything to do with forced egalitarianism and globalism. I mean, where do you see the radical shift come in within left-wing politics? Where, I mean, if you were to ask, you know, one of the guys in the trenches at Madrid on the Republican side of the Spanish Civil War, and you ask them about things, they talk about economics, they talk about class war. They were talking about wanting men in dresses, like going into women's bathrooms. So how did things so radically change within the organized left to just become puppets of capitalism instead of actually, like, you know, we might disagree with Marx's interpretation of history, but the modern left has in the West has no connection whatsoever to even a few generations ago of leftists. What radically changed?
Well, this is a question near and dear to me. This is something I followed very closely for a long time. The counterexample would be Leon Trotsky, who completely rewrote the concept of what a proletarian was. In his mind, Jacob Schiff was a proletarian, but a poor priest in Ukraine was a capitalist kulak. So that's, you know, so you did have some amongst the Jewish left many years ago, you did have that concept that this had nothing to do with the workers, this had nothing to do with capital. On the Soviet Union, I can't find all the 25 years I've been studying the Soviet Union, I can't find a single pro-labor piece of legislation. It had nothing to do with labor. It had nothing to do with workers or peasants. They were tormented under the Soviet system. It had to do with Jewish domination of the party, especially under Stalin, who was a philo-Semite. I got a paper coming out on that. It's a myth. He was not a nationalist. He was not anti-Semitic. That's absolute nonsense. But so Trotsky was pushing this notion that this isn't the workers. Karl Marx may have been concerned with that. That was about it. It was about power. It was about the state. And be able to call Jacob Schiff a proletarian shows that even back then, this was beginning. But I think the shift was in the 1960s. The Frankfurt School has a lot to do with this. Today, I've had those conversations that you talk about. In my particular case, it has a tendency to veer into you can't talk about how terrible globalization is and then say that you're against nations and borders. This doesn't make any sense. That's
right. It's Orwellian doublethink at its finest.
And they have nothing to do. Yeah, they think of it like this. You talk to Bernie Sanders, and this happened to me once online. I'm debating with one of these people, and they say that Bernie, you're against the bankers. Bernie's going to go against the banks. And I said, with what? And they said, well, you know, they're going to use the Justice Department and break them up. I said, the problem with that is that the banks are more powerful than the state. The state couldn't function for 5 minutes without credit from the banks. They simply aren't in a position to take on the banks legally. They tried to do it to Microsoft 20 years ago, and it failed. Microsoft is just more powerful than the state is. So unless you're talking about violent revolution, he's not going to do anything about the banks. The banks control the government, not the other way around. And that debate ended very quickly. It's very similar to what you're talking about. They made their peace with the private sector, and the new proletarians are homosexuals and feminists, even very wealthy ones. You know, a homosexual male in America is fairly well off financially, on average. So this is the new proletarian. The thing I had a lot to do with what was going on in the Frankfurt School in the early 70s. The concept of a proletarian has always been fluid in their mind. It's never been actual workers because they usually hate workers. You know, blue-collar workers are not exactly their friends. You know, they talk about proletarians, they mean intellectuals, university professors, they mean bankers, they mean, you know, the curator, the Smithsonian. These are all very well-off people. It has everything to do with power. You're exactly right to talk about this. These conversations are Orwellian. And they talk about capitalism, but then they say they don't want anything revolutionary to go on. They'll talk about a millionaire's tax in France, but no way to enforce it because you can't attack the group of people who control the state. It doesn't make sense. And it's really fun to watch their facial expressions. It's kind of a, to outleft them is fun. I totally get your connection to that. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's the thing that really gets me when you deal with them. I mean, to be able to discuss these ideas of, you know, they talk about the working class and things like that. And then you say, well, you know, the majority of the working, and they say, you know, we must stand up for the oppressed. And I've been in all these working class communities in Appalachia that are just racked with unemployment, with drugs, all these things, people that need help that have been hurt by globalism. It's not their fault that these politicians shipped their jobs overseas, sent the EPA to shut down the logging mills and the mines and things like that. And then you say, well, these guys support Trump because they, you know, that he's got positions that will actually bring jobs and economic growth and security to the working class. And they say, well, they're just a bunch of ignorant rednecks. You know, it instantly turns into this hick shaming. I mean, when I read, a great book I really enjoyed is Party Animals. It's a book that was written by a guy that's now, like, you know, some sort of generic conservative, but he was raised by parents that were members of the British Communist Party after the war. And, you know, he speaks in some parts about the champagne socialists. And it seems like the entire modern left in Western Europe and America is made up of a multicultural coalition that isn't really left-wing, of course. The non-whites just are trying to fight for their tribe. And I can respect them for that. That, you know, they're working against my people's interests. But at the very least, like the black community, the Hispanic community, things like that, are working for the interests of their tribe, their ethnic community. They want more programs, more money, more of a say, more of a seat at the table for their people. And, you know, I can disagree with their policies that hurt my people, but I can at least respect that. But it seems like between the, you know, the whites are all champagne socialists. All they do is from their ivory towers look down upon the people out of one side of their mouth. They say they're protecting. And in all their actions, you know, out of the other side of their mouth, They spit on them for being working class and clinging to their guns and their religion and their families and everything. And it sounds like the modern left really is pretty much exactly the same as the folks at National Review that, of course, had that article a few weeks ago that said that working class white communities deserve to die and should die because we're economic drains and we're holding back progress. I don't see a difference between the rhetoric coming out of the Champagne Socialists versus the neoconservative right, because both of them are just dedicated to displacing our people and spitting on everyday working class white folks.
I guarantee you, you talk about the party winning the seats in Greece and immediately doing what the EU wants. I'll bet you, though, I'll bet you my house that these guys, you'll still talk about the legislation that they did pass, and it'll be bringing in more third worlders, multiculturalism, anti-racism. But that, I guarantee you, they did, or at least tried to do. They could go back to their party, they could go back to the street and say, see what a good leftist I am, and then they'll talk about all of these multicultural things that they promoted. They'll steer the conversation away from economics altogether and talk about all of the non-whites that they promoted into the present system, government or private sector. So it's a closed circle. I even in college, I noticed that poor whites were treated like crap by the elite left. Especially, there was a specific event that changed my mind. In 1991, I remember I was at the University of Hartford in Connecticut at the time. There was a hunt in New England that was opposed by local environmentalists. I forget what they were hunting, but they were very much against it. And the environmentalists were placing themselves between the hunters and the hunted animals, as if to dare to shoot them. They showed a picture of these people coming down into the forest where this is going on. They were all coming out of Volvos and Mercedes. And these hunters were all very blue-collar people. And I said, "How this is a class war. There are clear class boundaries." Even when they quoted some of these hunters, that these rich guys coming from the cities and the suburbs who have no idea what they're doing, have no idea what rural life is like, what this hunt is even all about, but they have this weird, you know, emotional connection to these animals that they know nothing about. And it couldn't have been more odd, you know, dressed in suburban clothing in the forest. You know, they look ridiculous. And this has been a longstanding problem. The class war, someone like Karl Marx would not have had any problem with working class people with guns. But the modern left will take those guns away and place them under the state. But in exchange, they'll go to, you know, blacks and Hispanics and the third world movements, all corporate funded, by the way, funded by all the major corporations. La Raza has every major corporation in America sending it money, and say, "We've promoted your interests, and therefore we're good leftists." And that's how the closed circle seems to work.
Well, and it gives me an opportunity. We've got a few minutes left in the show, and we're going to have to do another one on this. But the economic situation in Venezuela, I wrote an article about it, and I actually got a lot of traction overseas in Latin America from it. But, I mean, the thing, of course, the false left-right dichotomy, where the Venezuelan Revolution under Hugo Chavez, was anti-globalist. The entire point was to be able to promote a bloc of Latin American countries to be anti-imperialist, and Chavez was actually rather Jew-wise. He allowed the Venezuelan state media outlets to sell the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and he referred to Jews as Christ killers in one of his addresses on Christmas and different things, opposing the, first thing when he took over power was oppose the IMF and the World Bank to be able to kick them out to try and promote cooperation among Latin Americans against Yankee imperialism, which of course he even defined as Jewish imperialism and aligning with Iran and Syria and Russia and other nations like that. And then, of course, you know, everyone I see, who is a normal conservative on my Facebook is talking about the failures of socialism because everyone's in breadlines and stuff like that. But the West is funding these opposition groups. That's an open secret at this point, that are trying to overthrow the Venezuelan Revolution just like they did in Ukraine, so they can open up the country, so they can have free markets and things like that. Can you just talk a little bit as we come to the last 5 or 6 minutes of the show, kind of on the idea that, you know, in Venezuela, for instance, they're facing an economic, catastrophe, kind of like France is, you know, with riots and stuff like that. But it seems the flip side of that, where they're having it because they're being punished by sanctions. They're being punished by the West funding these opposition groups to try and overthrow the revolution because they were nationalists. And then, of course, in France, we've got the working class resisting the globalist plans to replace them with third worlders. Could you talk a little bit about how in Venezuela and Latin America, they're so-called left-wing nationalists, but they seem to have much more on our side, and how the West is trying to break open these indigenous revolutions against global capitalism?
Well, you're right. Let's stop using the phrase left-wing. it gives a false sense of their ideology. That there's not a whole lot that these people are doing down there that Chavez was doing years ago that we don't disagree with. You know, he was on our side in every way. But you think about how the ruling class in America will mobilize different factions of the population to oppose Venezuela. They'll go to the right wing, or the American capitalist class, so-called rightists in America, and say, he's a socialist, he needs to be opposed. And they'll go to the left, and they'll say, look what anti-Semite he is, he needs to be opposed. This is how the ruling class will mobilize people in this country to fight a revolution like that. Locally, you hear a lot of right-wingers in America talking about, you know, how socialism is destroying Venezuela, without bothering to mention that they've been under sanctions for a long time, that governments around them have been taken over by the capitalist ruling class and are fighting them. That this violence, just like in Ukraine, has been fomented by the CIA and Western sources in Venezuela. This is what's destroying the country. When Chavez first took over, the economy was doing very well. The working class, the farmers were being given land that was owned by these capitalists that was sitting fallow for generations. It was a brilliant plan. You know, all of a sudden, these farmers now had land and production is going through the roof. With far more social stability, but the U.S. has decided that we're going to destroy this. And when it decides to do that, they have every weapon at their disposal. And they go to each group and show them how they have a stake in overthrowing Chavez, either from the right or the left in America. But down there,
with North Korea, for instance, where North Korea, you know, everyone talks about the famine there. And of course, I've got, you know, problems with some elements, of course, of the North Korean regime. But why was there this massive famine that killed in some places 20% of their population? Well, it's because we threw total sanctions on them and they had to completely refigure their economy to be more self-sufficient on food. I mean, what would happen in the United States if we stopped being allowed to import grain or corn from Iowa? You know, here in the Midwest, we would have a little bit of a problem and things like that. So they use it as an example to say, look how evil this regime is. Look at everything they're doing. They're torturing their own people. But they conveniently ignore the fact that it was Western-backed sanctions that caused this famine and millions of people to die.
Yeah, you know what? I don't believe anything that I hear about North Korea. You know, there's good elements there. There's negative elements there. But you notice you have a leftist anti-globalist saying, well, you know, if you really want to be hardcore about this, you're going to have to turn the country into North Korea. North Korea is being used to show if you really oppose globalization, this is your option. This is what you're going to have to be. But because there's no real communication between North Korea and the outside world, this is all coming from the capitalist ruling class here in this country. So I don't believe a damn thing. I don't know if 20% of the population died there or not. There's no way to verify it. So that's I'm not sure about that. But the general point is correct. It is
because that's our entire mission is to be able to alienate. And this is where, as nationalists, we need to, I think, really move beyond left and right, because North Korea, if I'm opposed to globalism, if I'm opposed to multiculturalism, if I support a healthy society that takes care of itself and honors its traditions, then, you know, even a communist regime like the DPRK has more in common with me than, you know, some, you know, like the white fighters in the Azov Battalion in Ukraine that are butchering, you know, fellow white people and fighting for Jewish oligarchs and bankers. I've got more in common with a, you know, with a slightly malnourished soldier of the DPRK than I do the Azov Battalion.
No, that's absolutely correct. Other than their attack on religion, which I don't understand where that's coming from, other than their attacks on religion, there's a lot right. As if, for example, in China or North Korea, if North Korea was able to trade freely, you know, that would be a separate matter. In America right now, it's illegal to trade with North Korea. They lifted sanctions on Cuba, which were almost non-existent anyway. But North Korea has a total block on any communication whatsoever. So the Azov Battalion, that freaks me out, because here you have nationalists with a strong, very solid, anti-Western nationalist tradition now knowingly supporting these oligarchs in Kiev. That's a totally separate issue altogether. I need like 3 days to go through all that.
Well, it's just the case that, again, if the battle of the 21st century is nationalism versus globalism, we need to move beyond the ideological rigidity, of previous generations and realize that people on the left-wing part of the spectrum, on the right-wing, and on the center, if they're opposed to globalism, they're our allies. If you support globalism, you're our enemy. And that's Professor Alexander Dugin, of course, spoke on that. If you support the liberal domination of the world, if you support globalism, you're my foe, you know, and that's kind of where we're at right now. So moving beyond that, so Dr. Johnson, we are we've come to the end of our show. Can you give our listeners a final thought on this topic to leave them with for the rest of the day?
Yeah, let me clarify one thing. In America, I still use left and right only because this is how we talk, and it's much easier to explain things that way. Globally, though, you're talking about different countries, different traditions. The American left-right has no relationship to the rest of the world. That's specific to America. So that's why locally and domestically I still use it. In foreign affairs, I can't use it because what those labels mean in America has no relationship to what it means abroad. So I would need to clarify that right away.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Johnson, thank you so much for being here to kick off another great week of the Daily Traditionalist. I always love having you on to be able to talk about these things. You know, you are one of the absolute best voices, not only in America, but in the world on the subject. So thank you so much for joining us. And to all my listeners, thank you guys for tuning in. And I'll look forward to being back tomorrow, same time, same place. So you guys have a great and wonderful rest of your day, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. Hail victory.
Be tuned into The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heimbach at RadioArea.com.